The Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications will be in order. Hello, members. It's been a long time since we've seen each other. Seems like these committee hearings get canceled for one reason or another. It's usually because we're on the floor. So if you remember last Tuesday, a week ago, we started our discussion with the Office of Legislative Auditor on the Renewable Development Fund. And so we're going to continue that today. And this will be the last day on testimony and just overview of this fund. We're going to hear from representatives of various organizations who have a hand in the grant, making decisions and execution and oversight of this fund. And, if you have questions during this discussion, just let us know. We'll get to the questions right away. So if we could have Bride Seifert and Linda Taylor please come up. Did I get that right, Ms. Seifert?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's perfect.
All righty.
So, Madam Chair, committee members, Bride Seifert, Manager of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. You've heard this before. I'm here today as a representative of the RDF board, and I'm going to talk about just for a few minutes on what I've seen since I've been on the board, which has been since November. So I'm as new as a few of you sitting at the table, but we only meet once a month, so I've learned a lot less. But what I have seen is the RDF board's response to the legislative auditor's report. And I've seen the thoughtfulness that goes into the response, and I've seen the willingness to address some of the concerns. As far as the board makeup goes, we are not legislatively created, but we were created from three different PUC orders from 2001 through 2006. Back in April of 2001, the PUC created the advisory board and put in two folks from the environmental community and two folks from Xcel Energy. In 2003, a representative from the Prairie Island Indian community was added. And in 2006, two ratepayer representatives were added, one from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the other from the Office of Energy Security. The Chamber thanks the PUC for putting ratepayer representatives. Obviously, the Chamber is more concerned with business ratepayers, and the Office of Energy Security covers the interests of all ratepayers across the board. As far as the tenure and how board members are picked, that's not something that is a formalized process right now, but the board, Xcel, the PUC, OES, everyone we've talked to is willing and ready to take some direction on that. Right now, it's the Chamber was, the ratepayer representative for business. OES was for all of the ratepayers in general. The environmental groups are chosen from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. That's a consortium of over 80 stakeholders that have environmental interests. They're going to be meeting in the very near future because we currently have a vacancy on the Renewable Development Fund board, and that is Bill Grant is now in charge of the Office of Energy Security. So folks from the environmental community will be getting together and advocating for that position to be filled. And again, Linda's going to talk more about the process and some of the successes that we've seen as a board. But what I want to stress is since the legislative auditor's report has come out, we've met with the PUC. We are developing sort of the RFP process for cycle four. And from a new member's perspective and from the Chamber's perspective as that member, it is a very thoughtful process, and it's very reflective of what we've read in the legislative auditor's report. It's very consensus building as a board member when we're around the table as a team. And I think that every person on the board has a very strong voice and it's respected. So I'm happy to take questions about the board development.
Yes, Ms. Seifert, again, how is that board member elected, or is it PUC designated, or does the board, the RDF board?
The board, it's my understanding that the board designates the who's going to be on the Xcel, and then that Minnesota Environmental Partnership chooses the environmental folks. The Office of Energy Security will choose their representative, and the chamber chooses. I inherited my position from the former energy manager. And I don't know if that needs PUC approval.
I don't think that it does. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just so I'm clear on this, there's no term then. There's no stated term on the...
There's no stated term at all. It's more... that's why I said we're happy, whether it's from the PUC, the board itself developing, or the legislative body that wants to give direction. Everyone on the board is open to having a more formalized process. It just doesn't exist. And as everyone knows, the OLA's report is the first of its kind for the RDF board.
Ms. Seifert, is it majority rule?
It's majority rule, and so far it's been a very, as far as the small part I've participated in, it's majority rule, but it is a consensus building process. Right now we're just working on developing what goes into cycle four, and you can see it evolve based on input from all of the different members.
And does this input come in from the various stakeholders, or is it just reports that you read, or where does this input come in from?
It comes from the board itself when they meet. So, the chamber listens to its members. I assume the Office of Energy Security folks, they have a wide variety of expertise. And then we come to the board as individuals representing our, for us, it's business ratepayers.
Well, so.
Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, do you, and Ms. Seifert or Ms. Taylor, who's chair of the board? Is that, do you have officers, or does that change, or just are y'all just together and have coffee, or what do you guys do?
I think I bring a water bottle myself, but I don't think it's not as formal as a secretary, president. I mean, we come to the board, and from what I have seen, we are equals at the board.
Okay, I do.
Senator Tibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the extent that anyone is interested in taking this on, this recommendation from the auditor on, anyone ever appear in front of Senator Rest's committee the last few years with an idea for a board, commission, agency, task force? She had a fairly lengthy list of questions you had to answer as you were presenting that idea to her committee. Mm-hmm. And I was sure to do that. It was questions like Senator Magnus asked, and, everything you could think of. What is this? What is its purpose? Does it have a sunset? Who's going to be on it? How are they going to get on there? Mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So someone might want to dredge that.
I think that's a very good idea, Senator
Dibble. Criteria mm-hmm. up from Senator Rest's office. It's a good discipline.
I think it would give some comfort to the board. It certainly would get comfort to us, but also to the board, knowing that there are these guidelines and boundaries and set rules. And
just, Madam Chair, if I might just
follow up on the
terms. So there's no terms, so I assume there's no term limits, and so you could serve on there till all of the fund disappears or what. So how long have some of the folks served on the board?
Ms. Seifert.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, I have been on the board since November of 2010.
I didn't mean you, Brad. Yeah.
Ms. Taylor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, I've been on the board for a year and a half, so you can see they sent the rookies.
Ms. Taylor, can you state your name for the record?
Sorry. I'm Linda Taylor. I'm the Clean Energy Director at Fresh Energy. I guess I would have to ask Mr. Zelnick and Ms. Trudeau how long they've been on the board. They've been on the board since before the last funding cycle, I understand. One member of the board had been on the board since the very beginning. That's a vacant position at this point. So I think it's the membership has shifted over time.
Okay. And, of course, these are recommendations that are given from the RDF board to the PUC, and they make the final.
Madam Chair, yes, we need to keep in mind that this board is an advisory board only. Mm-hmm. This is not really a decision-making body. There's nothing is set in stone when this group makes a decision. We recommend things to Xcel Energy, who submits them to the Public Utilities Commission, either in their original form or with changes. And the Public Utilities Commission makes decisions and either amends or adopts whatever is put in front of them. So there are several points at which the advisory board is, in fact, just advisory.
Mm-hmm. And it would be, perhaps this is a question for the PUC or for Excel, but how often the recommendations from the RDF board are just accepted without any changes? And
Madam Chair, I think Ms. you would Taylor. Have to ask that of someone other than the two rookies on the board. If I may, Madam Chair, I had some other comments to make
Absolutely.
About process.
Yes, please, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, since joining the board about a year and a half ago, I've been impressed with how regularized the process has become for making decisions on how to spend the money in the Renewable Development Fund. I'm going to talk a little bit about the process and about some of the projects that have been funded. I guess I chose my favorites. I think other people would have other favorites. The process is really pretty rigorous. We, as you know, have had oversight over about 44% of the money that has been spent out of the Renewable Development Fund. So we've had sort of a minority role here, but we think we've funded some good projects, some projects that have benefits for the state and for Xcel ratepayers going forward. Looking at the process starts with the board essentially getting together and deciding on criteria for funding, for a round of funding. There has, as you know, there have been three rounds of funding, or three cycles of funding in the past. We are looking at the fourth funding cycle now. So the advisory board gets together and puts together the criteria that we would like to see for projects in any given funding cycle. Then together, the advisory board, the staff at Xcel Energy, put together a request for proposals. And that request for proposals includes the goals, includes timelines, and it includes selection and evaluation criteria. Then that proposed request for proposal goes to the Public Utilities Commission, where the Office of Energy Security comments, commission staff comments, anyone from the public can comment on how that request for proposals is put together. At that point, the Public Utilities Commission approves the request for proposals, either with or without changes to it. And then that request for proposals, of course, goes out into the market. Once the timeline has been met and project proposals are in, there are a couple of paths. One is there could be an independent contractor if additional technical help was needed looking at these proposals. I think that was especially true in the past in funding some research and development projects where there were very technical research projects proposed. There would be an independent contractor who would come in and help with the analysis of whether that met the criteria, the evaluation criteria, et cetera. Also, the board members spend a great deal of time in looking at these proposals, making recommendations. Then there's sort of a free-for-all, it appears to me, where everybody picks their favorites, and then once again that consensus develops among the board members. Once there is a consensus, the recommendation goes back to the Public Utilities Commission for which projects to fund. And the Public Utilities Commission, once again, there is OES comment, public commission staff comment, and an opportunity for the public to comment on what projects actually get funded. Once the PUC approves projects for funding, then, of course, there is a commitment letter that goes out to project proposers and with timelines for milestones that must be met. And then the grants are given out on a reimbursement basis as the timelines are met for the grants. The process has certainly evolved over time. And while we think there is certainly room for improvement, as noted in the auditor's report, for the most part, the projects that have been funded have been successful. Some of the completed projects, and I think you may have a couple of fact sheets that with some pretty color pictures that talk about some of the projects. I think there's one fact sheet that looks at research projects and one that looks at production projects. some of those completed projects, and once again, these are my favorites. There's a small innovative run of River Hydro, Lower St. Anthony Falls project, I understand just today, but that project is going to be operational in April of this year. That project was part of the Cycle 3 funding. There's high-density, low-emission biomass briquettes from agricultural waste. And one of my real personal favorites is this small solar wind battery combination to power remote switches for the West Central Minnesota Telephone Association, a very innovative project that is really pretty interesting going forward. Methane production from sugar beet tailings, biodiesel from algae that feeds on coal-fired flue gases, large battery storage of wind-generated electricity to firm wind capacity, aggregated small residential and commercial solar leased installations, larger solar photovoltaic installations such as at St. John's University and on the Minneapolis Convention Center. Over time, you know, the board and Xcel and the Public Utilities Commission have kind of modified how we have approached projects, reflecting, I think, changes in the marketplace and reflecting what's doable. For example, cycles 1 and 2 focused on smaller wind projects and some research and development things. Cycle 3 focused more on solar generation projects and projects that were closer to commercialization. In the proposed Cycle 4 funding round, we're proposing even more focus on actual energy production and technology commercialization. And those projects certainly would be very much located in Minnesota and probably located in Xcel's service territory. There is a biannual report, the 2008 biannual report for fund expenditures, does identify ratepayer and electric system benefits, and the biennial report for 2010, which will be available shortly, will do the same. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mitzen.
Yeah, Ms. Taylor, just piggybacking on the question I asked the other day, do you know how many of these projects are Minnesota-based, built and by Minnesota people and Minnesota contractors?
Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair and Senator Mitzen, no, I would have to guess. And I think that would be a better question for the administrators at Xcel Energy. They will have that data at their fingertips. For the most part, the production projects are definitely in Minnesota and for the most part in Xcel's service territory. The research and development projects were not necessarily always Minnesota-based, I think. But
Madam
I think
Chair.
That Tim Edmond from Xcel Energy could answer that question better than
Senator Mitzen.
Madam Chair, they should be, all things being equal, Minnesota contractors and Minnesota laborers that are doing these jobs. I mean, we talked about it the other day that it's the ratepayers in the Xcel district that are paid for that, and those are people in my district and many other members of the committee's district. So if at all possible, they should be Minnesota-based and contractors and Minnesota labor people doing these projects.
Senator Mitzen, I agree totally with you. On page 64 of some of the projects, of course, some of them are closed, the status, and some are in progress. But just in Senator Magnus's committee at 1 o'clock here, we talked about sugar beets. And there was $1 million that was sent to the University of Florida for sugar beets to methane project, and we're the number one sugar beet state in the nation. So, I mean, there's just some here that just does not make sense. And I agree that these projects should be, even though it does, you know, further advancement and research and all that, but they still should stay in Minnesota. Yeah. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering, can you tell us how much money has, since the fund's been created, has went through the board recommendation process?
Ms. Taylor?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I can't give you the exact figure. I know that 44% of the money since the inception of the fund has gone through the Advisory Board Excel Public Utilities Commission process. So it's 44% of what, $195 million? So
about $90 million then?
About
Ms. Taylor.
65 million.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Would you, the recommendations on here as far as the board structure and what's your thoughts on that?
Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, my personal thoughts, and I think probably shared by the other board members, is that greater structure, perhaps, you know, terms, perhaps finding representatives of other perspectives, more formalized statutory procedures. I don't think any of us have any problem with additional specificity on those issues.
Senator Howe.
I know we were being a little jocular earlier, but, you know, it's ratepayer money that we're talking about, and to have that kind of amount go through without maybe a little bit better formal structure and a vetting process, you know, for the participants, I think would be a significant improvement. It's surprising that there hasn't been a more formal structure.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
And Senator Howe, I agree, actually.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Seifert, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you.
Director Bill Brandt and Mr. DeFebri from the Office of Energy Security, please. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Director.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
And
thank you to the committee. There are a number of you who I've worked with before, of course, and several of you who are new to the committee who I have not had the chance yet to meet and hope to soon, and look forward to working with all of you.
Mr. Grant, could you please?
Yes, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Bill Grant with the Office of Energy Security, Department of Commerce. And I'm here with Jeremy DeFebri, and just a few introductory remarks before I turn things over to Mr. DeFebri. First, in terms of my involvement with the fund itself, I guess I was, until recently, the longest-serving member of the board. In fact, started when the board was created in 1999. And just by way of a little bit of a history lesson on this, why 1999 when the Prairie Island legislation was passed in 1994? Well, it took 5 years in order to really come to an agreement about how the fund would go forward, be administered. There was legislation, as you all know, that passed then in 1999 that created the fund, but it was very nonspecific about how those funds would be administered and what kind of advisory role the board would play. It didn't even really name a board. And so we have been somewhat without direction in that respect ever since. And I think that the board now has good representation from the interests that were key to the original agreement and to the ratepayers that actually are responsible for paying for projects that are recommended under the fund. But that certainly isn't to say that it couldn't be improved through a more formalized process. I think some of the recommendations that the legislative auditor made in that regard are certainly worth considering. I did want to clarify, though, that projects that are recommended by the board do go through a very thorough RFP process. Those projects, once we get responses to the RFP, are then scored by the consultant that we use to establish a ranking of projects in terms of meeting a variety of criteria. And those include things like the extent to which the projects are replicable, will have value to Minnesota ratepayers, really have real value going forward. We've also, over time, emphasized different technologies, different types of approaches in each of the various cycles of grants that we've gone through. But I wanted to be clear that to the extent that in the past there have been some out-of-state projects that have come through the board process and been recommended, it was because, A, they were received in response to an RFP. They scored most highly by the consultant, and the Public Utilities Commission was and is very keen to be sure that projects are not being selected on a basis other than the criteria that were established in the RFP, which, and the RFP is something that we share with the commission before before we release it. So there, in order to maintain a fair process, it really needs to, I think, go through a process like that. And the simple fact is that in some cases we had out-of-state research projects that frankly scored much better than anything that we got from in-state researchers. And that's the reason why we ended up with a couple of projects from out-of-state research firms. It's not to say that we didn't have scoring criteria that favored Minnesota projects. We did. Those projects rose to the top even in spite of the fact that we gave preferential credit to in-state Minnesota-based projects. So I wanted to clarify that for you quickly, and I can answer any questions you might have on it. The renewable energy production incentive is the piece that our office has had responsibility for. Well, it was at first a general fund obligation, and in 2003 became at least partially funded by the Renewable Development Fund. And then in 2005, REPI became totally the responsibility of the Renewable Development Fund. And one thing to note about that, of course, is that REPI is a statewide program, and XL ratepayers, of course, have a service territory that they come from that does not encompass the entire state. So to the extent that we're trying to maximize benefit for XL's customers, REPI, at least in some instances, is not the best tool to accomplish that task. However, I think it has been a great tool for accomplishing a fair amount of renewable energy production that would not otherwise have occurred. And I'm going to turn the ball over to Mr. DeFevre to walk you through kind of where we've been with this and what some of the current statistics are.
Welcome, Mr. DeFevre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a little bit different after many years to be sitting next to Mr. Grant, but it's I think it's going to be enjoyable, although I hate to take this first time to correct him on something, but every time that he referred to we, when he was referring to the Renewable Development Fund board, he actually meant they. That's
okay. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Fevre, could you please?
I'll get over that. I'll get over that eventually.
Yeah, it might take a while. Could you please
get over that?
Certainly. My name is Jeremy DeFevre, and I work at the Department of Commerce Office of Energy Security. And I'd actually like to refer to a couple of handouts that were given to you earlier. And the first is actually unrelated to REPI, but there were a number of questions related to solar rebate programs. Where the funding had come from over time. And so we put together a listing of solar rebate programs that our office has operated over the past 9 years. And I don't have any presentation related to that other than that we thought that given that there were questions that this might be something that the committee would find useful. So with that said, I'd like to move on to the
chair. Right.
Oh, yes, Senator Magnus.
To that point, Mr. LeFevre, I see the solar thermal total $595,000, and it looks like there's about $309,000 available. What's the status on that? Are any of those funds committed? Do you plan on having a process to commit those? What's the What's the story in getting those out to do it? Most of that is the federal AAR money, right?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, that's correct. It is mostly ARA money. Of the $500,000 that we have allocated for the solar thermal rebates under ARA, we have either reserved or expended a little under $200,000. So there is $305,000 left. We have been encouraging the solar manufacturers and solar vendors in that area to try and pick up the pace on that program. We have been reluctant to reallocate those funds up to now because we do have a few in-state manufacturers that feel, if given a little bit more time, that they will be able to sell a significant amount of product using the rebate. But we are also getting to a point where we do need to program those dollars. So as I think I said in a previous appearance, that we are looking at all of the remaining ARA funds that we have and whether where they're currently allocated is going to get the job done.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus.
If those aren't used on solar thermal projects, can they be used on another project? Is that what I'm hearing you say? They could be used at another, they could be used on something else besides solar thermal, for example?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, those were under an appropriation in Laws 09, Chapter 138, that was $3 million for solar rebates. So we had divided $2.5 million for photovoltaics and $500,000 for solar thermal. So we could certainly apply that to photovoltaics, or under Chapter 138, there's a reallocation process for those funds to other activities that were authorized under that chapter.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Yes, Madam Chair. I have a question about the solar rebate programs. Mr. Grant had said that the REPI payments that go out are statewide, and it's broader than just benefiting Xcel ratepayers. Is the solar rebate program benefiting strictly Xcel ratepayers, or is that a more broad program than that?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, the initial grant that we received in 2002 under the competitive RFP for RDF funds was Xcel territory only. The rebate programs that we have had since then have been statewide.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
I have some concern in that the REPI payments, for what I see, 2011, 2012, 2013, are projected to be almost half the amount of what's actually coming into the fund. Is that accurate?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, yes, it is accurate. REPI is authorized. There is in law up to $10.9 million for wind, biogas, and hydro incentive payments.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two things. One is that Mr. DeFebvre, you must not be including the new solar rebate program that we passed last year, because that's only available to Xcel ratepayers, and that's for $19 million. We talked about that before, so maybe you're not including that.
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, no, I'm not including that because it does not program through our office. Xcel Energy will be programming that directly.
And Madam Chair, but that is Renewable Development Fund solar rebate. So, yeah, it's not on your list. Mm. But it is an Xcel-only program, the new one. Because we were really sensitive to that issue last year. We started talking about that more than we have in the past. The other thing I just wanted to ask is for REPI, do you have any idea how much of that wind production was sold to Xcel so that actually Xcel customers would have used some of that wind power? Is there any way to figure that out?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I don't have a specific number with me. I can certainly figure it out because we do know each of those facilities has a PPA And so we can go back and track how many kilowatt hours over time were sold to Xcel. My guess is it would be approximately two-thirds of them because most of the PPAs were with Xcel.
Senator Brown?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, you bring up a good point, and I'm glad you do. I think it points to an underlying issue with the RDF fund, and possibly it has a lack of focus. And I'm glad you brought that up, and maybe that's one of the jobs we'll have on this committee is to bring about a little more focus to the RDF fund.
Mr. Fabry, what is the, or Director Gant, what is the schedule for phasing out of the RIPI payments year by year? Oh. Never mind. I have it. Do you have that information available to you, too?
Madam Chair, on the one of the handouts, it's two-sided, and there's a graph on one side that shows the significant impact on REPI is the wind capacity that's on it, and that eligibility for that closed, I believe, on January 1, 2007, although I need to look that up to be sure. January 1, 2008. I believe actually the last of the projects that that became operational that was eligible will time out its 10 years in 2016. The remainder of the eligibility, hydro goes to 2021, and biogas, in theory, goes to beyond that. But we are, under current law, authorized to make payments only for production through the end of 2015. So one can become eligible up till 2017, but they can be eligible for, you know, good thoughts from us, perhaps, but no cash.
Okay. And members, you do have a handout, the REPI handout here on both sides. It does explain that. Mr. DeFreebre or Director Grant, could you explain the clean energy resource teams, what those are?
Madam Chair, clean energy resource teams are a network of local entities under a sort of umbrella, not direction, but coordination through both a University of Minnesota entity, and I, off the top of my head, the name of it is escaping me, and the what has been the Green Institute operating MetroCerts that was recently transferred actually to Eureka Recycling because of fiscal problems at Green Institute. They provide umbrella organization and some seed grant money to local entities that want to organize in their communities and develop both expertise and help move both energy projects and energy efficiency projects and renewable energy projects in their cities, counties, towns. They are. It is a statutory activity under 216C.385.
And is this, the certs, is this tracked at, on the U's budget breakout at all, or is this just a separate? Actually, the question is, do any of these projects at the University of Minnesota, are they tracked in either their ag budget spreadsheet, or is it just kind of a separate funding that is just coming from the RDF? How do you know?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, the university doesn't make a contribution to certs out of its budget, so the RDF grant that it receives through our office would be tracked through their sponsored projects administration as you know, grant income. It would not show up, as far as I know, in any other place in their budget. It does show up in appropriations as RDF funds appropriated to us for that purpose.
Further questions for the two? Thank you, Director Grant and Mr. DeFreebre for coming and appreciate your testimony. And now we have Mr. Jonathan Foley from the Initiative of Energy and Environment.
Good
Welcome, Director Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'll be joined by Rodney Larkins, who's the Associate Director of the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, and we'll be showing you a PowerPoint presentation.
Could you please state your name for the record?
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Jonathan Foley. I'm the Director of the Institute on the Environment for the University of Minnesota, which manages the IRE program for the university.
Do we have a handout also? We do. We have actually several handouts, I believe. Senator Manson, don't you have a joke or something? fill the time. Come on. Just one little one.
Well, a lot of this has been a joke here this week. we'll fine-tune some of this stuff as we go through the process, I'm sure. But
are you asking me for help? That's a joke. Right there.
I don't know.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've prepared a short presentation to help you understand a bit more about the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, an initiative at the University of Minnesota. And I'll be happy to go through these slides with you and then entertain any questions that may come up along the way or afterwards, however you see fit. First of all, basically, we'll be giving a short presentation of the history of this program and why we think it's important to the state of Minnesota. It plays a particular role within the Renewable Development Fund, which we think is unique and very powerful. And also to give you an overview of how we work, how we select proposals for funding, how we manage these funds, how they've been leveraged, and give you a few examples of success stories. And the audience, actually, we have two members of our faculty who are part of that success story who could also answer some questions if called upon. So to begin, a bit of history. The IRE program was actually established in 2003, initially with two sources of funding, partly the Renewable Development Fund, but also through the SIP obligation. It started off with $10 million of RDF funding and then $2 million per year for 5 years through the SIP funds. We had a very clear legislative mandate, which I'll show you in a minute, for the utilization of those funds, which we've been following to the letter ever since that time. In 2007, the funds were renewed and expanded to roughly $5 million per year and then shifted exclusively to the RDF fund. That constitutes roughly 20% of the RDF funding that we see today. We were given a very clear mandate by the legislature during that time, which we follow very rigorously, which was very, very broad and includes these five elements. Basically, the environmentally sound production of energy, energy writ largely, not just electricity, I should stress. That has been a question that's come up. Number two was focused on hydrogen generation, which is something that was very interesting, especially in the mid-2000s, to many in Minnesota and into the scientific community. I think now, more recently, that has faded a little bit. Number three, development of energy conservation and efficiency measures. Number four, energy storage. And number five, policy options regarding the deployment and utilization of renewable energy. We transformed that language from the legislature into what we hope is a short and succinct kind of mission statement that we share with all of our stakeholders, that our job is to really promote statewide economic development, sustainable, healthy, and diverse ecosystems, and national energy security through the development of bio-based and other renewable resources and processes. So we've been very careful to adhere to the legislative intent and to our mission statement every day. So again, to stress, our legislative intent has been clear, focusing on energy, not just electricity. And we look really at the whole system of production, utilization, transmission, and storage, but with a particular expertise of the University of Minnesota being deployed here, which is primarily going to be focusing on technology, science, and policy analysis.
Mr. Foley, hold on. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foley, I'm going back here to the statutes where you talk about number two there, hydrogen. We're looking at biomass and for energy storage, energy utilization, and I think you mentioned that the glamour from that star has kind of faded. Are you still doing work on that, or have you made some modifications or reported back on really this isn't going to work?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, if I may respond to that. Yes, we do very, very little on hydrogen in the last two funding portfolios. I think in the mid-2000s, personally speaking, I was not at the university at that time. I believe nationally there was quite a lot of interest in hydrogen, and since that time, many other technical challenges have arisen. And so I think its star has faded somewhat, but not completely.
But, Madam Chair, your funding is not – your funding you had looked at for that segment really is going somewhere else now, or
– the legislative mandate
–
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, yes, the funding has been redeployed in a fluid way across those five areas as the legislative intent really specified is to say these are the areas to be included but not limited to. And so we redeployed as our external reviewers indicated and the proposals came in that were the most strong. So we basically make decisions based on merit, not based on some predetermined allocation of where we're going. But our interest in hydrogen, while that has maybe waned slightly, we have invested more in ammonia, which is also a critically interesting application of similar technologies.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, when they created the mission statement, did they take into account what the mission statement was for the PUC on the RDF?
Mr. Howe. Or Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I cannot answer that accurately. I wasn't here at the time, and the person who could answer that best is not here today. I can get back to you about that, though, and answer that question more carefully later on. I'm sorry I can't answer that. Okay, well, if I should continue then. I think one of the things I wanted to stress, though, today is that one of our top priorities really is how this kind of work can really affect Minnesota's economy, making it stronger and more competitive. And that may sound a little bit odd because we're mainly a research institute. And you may say, well, why should we support research? Shouldn't it be just more steel in the ground? And we're making the case, though, I hope, that innovation is part of our economic competitiveness. If you think about what is succeeding in the American economy today, it isn't just going to be manufacturing last year's technology. In that sense, we are at a competitive disadvantage internationally. But in inventing next year's technology and next decade's technology, the U.S. actually has a competitive advantage over every nation in the world. And we believe research institutions can play a very big role in that. So, again, research and innovation, we feel, are crucial to the economy. But we also feel that they shouldn't happen in a vacuum. Research by itself in the ivory tower doesn't do any good. And so we really believe in this model here, where we see a continuum of kind of basic and applied research, which is really the mainstay of places like the University of Minnesota, moving into pilot scale and demonstration projects, and then ultimately to commercial applications, which are best done in the private sector. We believe that this kind of sweet space in the middle, indicated by these arrows, is really where there needs to be more activity and where we are very, very eager to push even harder. And our interpretation of the Renewable Development Fund is it spans this whole continuum. And so we try very, very hard to do the best science we can, but to make sure that science does good work in the real world and gets into the commercial sector. Unfortunately, though, this process takes ongoing long-term investment, and it takes time. When you think about the energy infrastructure of this country, we have to remember that the average power plant in the United States is between 60 and 70 years old. A lot of them built during the Roosevelt administration. Franklin, not Theodore, but still very, very old technology. And we're talking about completely rebuilding these kinds of infrastructure. So it does take considerable time and energy to do that, no pun intended. But we really need to sustain these kinds of investments and make sure they pay off from their initial foundation. So a bit more about how we work and how we make our selection of process of projects. We issue a call for proposals recently about every year or two. I can go through the details if you'd like. But essentially every year or two, we put out a call for proposals to the University of Minnesota system, not just the Twin Cities, but all five campuses of the U of M. We have currently three kinds of grants that we look for. Not very imaginative, but we call them large grants for large team-based projects. Smaller seed grants for kind of pilot projects that are kind of getting an idea off the ground. And very recently, we started something called early career grants, which are helping to bring new blood and new ideas and new people into the renewable energy space. We first screen every proposal and every letter of intent for strict compliance with the legislative mandate. We take that very seriously and never stray from it. We then subject them to what I think is one of the most rigorous external reviews panels I've ever seen, and I've been on hundreds of these myself nationally. So, and I'll tell you about that in a bit more. And then we also look very carefully at where the funding would go. We've taken it as a given that the funding should stay in Minnesota, and unless there are exceptional circumstances, all funding from our grants stay in Minnesota. Occasionally, a very small fraction of these funds may go to a partner outside to facilitate a collaboration that's deemed essential, but that's very much the exception, not the rule. We conduct a very rigorous and objective, efficient, and we believe very effective peer review of these proposals where we take national experts. We do not use Minnesota-based reviewers. We go to the very best people in the world and in the country, not from within the university itself, that are looking at the scientific and technical merit of these projects, their innovation and ingenuity, whether they're unique and provide an a competitive advantage for Minnesota, and do they have a significant potential to make a difference in the energy system. We use some just the best people in the country from academic institutions like Stanford, Berkeley, Wisconsin, Michigan, you name it, from national laboratories, from world-leading business and industry partners, and from government agencies, and bring them together into both written and panel-based reviews. Last year, our panel, many of them commented that they had just been at the Department of Energy headquarters in Washington, D.C., and felt that our panel was even better than theirs and that they saw higher quality proposals. And I can tell you we're very proud of that. The portfolio of projects we selected through these kinds of processes is quite interesting and very, very unique. First, I should stress that they really come from across a continuum of different fields, that we think that these whole system solutions for energy generation, storage, and utilization need to come from different disciplines, and they do, from across the university system. And they basically end up in these four main categories, bio-based energy and products, solar-based energy, wind, hydropower, and geothermal, and conservation and energy efficiency. The relative sizes of these change from year to year, but we've invested in all four, as well as kind of an undergirding program looking at policy, economics, and environmental and ecological implications of energy choices, as well as some efforts on education and outreach that we feel are very, very important too. We've invested in both these large grants with roughly 57% of the funding so far, a very small fraction in early career grants, about 10% in seed funding, some special opportunity funding, and 10% for matching grants that I'll tell you about in a minute. So far, we've awarded roughly $31 million in funding since this program started, the average grant size being about $150,000. We've had some really significant impacts that we're actually quite proud of, and I'd like to tell you a bit about.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, Mr. Foley, I just have a quick question. Mm-hmm. What percentage of your research and development dollars comes from the RDF?
Mr. Foley.
Do you know?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, do we?
The question would be, is he talking about the IRA investment? That would be the question I would ask.
I was looking at the last pie chart that you had.
Yeah. I'd have to get back to you with the exact figures on that. I'd have to say the majority, for sure. The only other source of funding we've had for this has been from the early SIP funding from the phase one of IRE. More recently, all of the funding we received has been through the RDF mechanism.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Foley.
Thank you. This shows year by year the awarded funding in green, how much funding has been awarded, starting with a combination of SIP and RDF funding, and more recently, all RDF funding. And in blue is something that we want to highlight is that we've also leveraged considerable other funding. The blue funding is non-state of Minnesota funding. These are non-RDF or SIP funds, mostly from federal sources. And we show over the years, especially the last couple of years, that we have accurate data like FY09 and FY10, that we've had very good success in taking these initial investments with our very entrepreneurial faculty and then helping to leverage additional investment from often federal agencies or private sector investments, often between 6-1 or 8-1 in recent years, which has been excellent. A particular part of the program is actually designed explicitly for that. We've set aside some funding explicitly for matching grants where we can help Minnesota-based scientists and engineers and policy analysts to go get additional funding and bring it here to Minnesota. So for every dollar of these funds we've invested, we've already brought in an additional 9 into the state, And currently we have another $12 million pending of other external funding with a 1-to-7 multiplier ratio.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is the question I was asking the other day. And I think you answered part of it. So two questions. One is, are any of the projects or research projects that you fund exclusively and solely RDF funding? And is that desirable? I mean, is this a place where we want to perhaps fund research that is very worthy that would otherwise not qualify for some of this match? That's the first question. Second question is, you said you had a special kind of matching program. What percentage of your resources are set into that initiative or that effort? And how do you weight the criteria for a proposal that identifies matching dollars?
Mr. Foley?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that's an excellent question. I can go back to this previous slide here. Well, maybe these are in the printouts. But to your first question, yes, we are funding some projects that are exclusively still funded by RDF. But what this does is it helps give our faculty and our scientists and engineers really a leg up on their national competition. There are not many programs like this around the country, where university-based scientists can really explore a new technology, get that initial data, that proof of concept, and then go back to, let's say, Department of Energy or ARPA-E or whatever it is, one of these, maybe a national program, or go to industry with a proof of concept. And that makes them so much more effective in getting those additional dollars. So many of our grants are started with RDF funding and then greatly expanded upon, and the work goes on to many new directions based on that initial investment, as I'm showing here. So
I see. So,
yes, Senator Dibble.
So to be clear, okay, that makes sense. So a proposer could start the first phase of their inquiry with exclusively RDF dollars, and then if it looks promising, use some RDF dollars to match some of these sources that you're identifying.
Mr. Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, exactly right. And we also, that's in general with all of our funding, so like our any one of our grants, one of the things we look for is saying, is this a good investment for us? We really want to take the state of Minnesota's dollars, $1 and turn it into $5. That's a good deal for our ratepayers, we think. It's a good deal for Minnesota. It's a good deal for the university. So we've been very, very careful to do that and making sure that's something we, really try to emphasize. If we can make the down payment on a good investment, can we attract $5 more dollars for every dollar we invest, for example? That's something we don't make mandatory, but it's something we really like to encourage and see happen. In particular, though, we did set aside a special funds called just for matching grants themselves. Sometimes federal agencies, for example, require some actual cash match, often up to 20%, for you to get a large federal grant. Department of Energy, USDA, and others often do that. And so, we are never going to be the exclusive source of that match. We don't like to be the only skin in the game, so to speak. But we are often one of those sources, and we often team up with other partners across the state to make that happen. And that's what these funds show here. So we do that both proactively as well as kind of serendipitously as we can move ahead with these projects.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foley, this was looking at, the grant contract under the NSP/Excel grants, and there's certain intellectual property rights that are retained under that grant with all this mixture of funding and grants, and you say that you have a good value for the ratepayer. What's your deal with property rights, intellectual property rights, patents? Who retains the ownership? Is there any part of potential marketing monies that might go back to the ratepayers when things are invented and patented?
Madam Chair, Senator Youngma. Yes, that's a very good question. The university, of course, has a policy that they basically control the intellectual property of things created within the University of Minnesota. And as a largely public institution, we try to guard those in the benefit of the university and taxpayers and other stakeholders of the university. There have been a number of cases where, there have been intellectual property and patent. I'll show you a couple examples of this where patents have been filed, of course, from these IRE investments, and even ideas for new companies have started. And we've been very much trying to accelerate those kinds of investments that would benefit the whole state of Minnesota, we believe.
Senator Jumbo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Foley. So then the patents, the intellectual property then belongs to the university even though the funding was all from other sources?
Mr. Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Youngbauer, yes, that's in fact the case with nearly all funding to the university, whether public or private. Essentially, the university retains the rights of intellectual property, is my understanding. I believe that's correct.
Senator Jungbrath.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Foley. To members even, it doesn't look like that's the case when the grant comes directly from Excel to other things. That there's other potential intellectual property rights retained by Excel and therefore have a direct benefit back to the potentially direct benefit back to the ratepayer. So, Mr. Foley, I'm trying to, you know, make that connection for ratepayers and for citizens of Minnesota. So how do we make that connection that intellectual property that benefits University of Minnesota would then directly benefit both ratepayers and citizens of Minnesota that made that investment in terms of whether it's tax dollars or, as Mr. Noble said, extracted funds?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's a very good question. I might have to get back to you with some more comments on that later. I'm going to have to ask some questions. But generally speaking, when the university receives funds from whatever source we do, when we create intellectual property, it's usually entrusted to the regents of the University of Minnesota. And then we often use that in the often in the public interest or often in other ways. I'd have to get back to you with specific examples. I don't believe there have been any cases so far where IRE grants have generated royalty revenues to the university, though, at this point. But.
And Madam Chair?
Oh, and I should add, we can send you our region's policy on this. My colleague just indicated we can send you that to clarify that. I'm afraid I'm not an expert on our legal policies. I'm just a humble scientist. So.
Senator Jumper.
Madam Chair, Mr. Foley, I'm not trying to suggest that the university is not benefiting Minnesota. I just want to make it clear to members. I was over at, they had a deal honoring inventors at the university the other day, and I went over there to look at and talk to a lot of the inventors, and many of their products are, in fact, directly affecting Minnesotans in a positive way. So in no way am I trying to say that it's not benefiting Minnesotans, but I think, Mr. Foley, that we at this committee, you know, need to be able to make that argument. So we need whatever tools you can give us to make that argument back to our constituents and the ratepayers.
Thank you, Senator Jungbrath. Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foley, is IRE dollars being used for policy work?
Mr. Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, yes, some of the, as was in our legislative mandate, a very small fraction, I would say, I could get you the exact number later on, is used for studies that are looking at energy policy issues in the region and in the state, of course, regarding renewable energy. But that's very clearly in the mandate that we were handed.
Thank you.
Again, I should add, it's a relatively small fraction.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
You can call me anything. Madam Chair. As long as we're on that train of thought, just a real quick question. Is it used to promote the university, like with some of the, you know, we see the ads on TV, are some of the funds used to actually promote the department and the university itself? Or?
Mr. Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, no, absolutely not. We use a very small fraction of the funds for purely administrative purposes for managing the grants, which, by the way, are matched by other resources outside of the RDF of the university itself. We also use a very small fraction of the funds to help promote more partnerships between the university and especially the private sector. We really want to coordinate what we're doing with business in Minnesota. And look, I'll show you some examples of those in a minute, but we would never use these funds for promoting the university on television commercials or that kind of thing. We do support some meetings and other things to help promote partnerships and sponsorships of events and that kind of thing about awareness of renewable energy, but not for strictly PR purposes for the university like you're indicating.
I wasn't indicating. I was just asking the question.
Okay.
Understood.
And in the report, Mr. Foley, it says, by PUC order, Excel's administrative costs must not exceed 5% of the total annual allocation. Do you have a percent cap on your administrative costs? Because I know the OES doesn't have any administrative costs, but the University of Minnesota does, and Excel. That they could use these funds for administrative costs is what I'm trying to say. Do you have a cap on that?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. And we're going to be providing you with a more detailed accounting of this since this question has come up. Our analysis of this, of the administrative functions within the IRE program have so far with the RDF funds. Now, realize we also have received funds through the SIP mechanism, which are can be accounted for in addition to this. But through the RDF funds, we estimate that we're using about 3.59% of funds for administrative purposes, and that anything beyond that is paid for by the university itself. We use another 3.4% for outreach and partnership opportunities to, again, connect to business and other organizations across the state, because we feel that's very important to make sure this work doesn't just sit alone in the ivory tower, and another 0.6% for things like sponsorships. So we believe that we are following, you know, certainly under 5% for administrative functions.
Questions? Mr. Foley, I would like to get Commissioner Wergen up here. So if there's anything in here that we absolutely should see, I would appreciate that. Otherwise, if we could.
I will then just proceed very, very quickly maybe
thank you.
Through here. One other thing we wanted to mention was that we've also been tracking creation of jobs. Now, while a lot of people might say, well, these are at the university, we'd argue, well, they're still jobs. And these are also recruiting very talented people to Minnesota, kind of reversing the brain drain seen in other parts of the Midwest. We're bringing very smart people here to the workforce of Minnesota. And anecdotally, we find most of those people stay here after we've trained them, and they stay here and work in industry, helping to contribute to the talent pool of our state, which we think is another important function of the university. And we have a number of success stories that I'll go through very quickly. You can see in writing, of course. Professor Martin Saar behind me has been developing very interesting technologies on using carbon capture as not only an environmental mitigation, but also an energy production tool, how to generate more energy with carbon capture as well as reduce CO2 emissions. And our initial $600,000 investment in that project so far led to a $1.8 million DOE grant and another $6.5 million pending DOE grant, with partnerships in industry, new patents being filed, and the preparations to start a new company based here in Minnesota. So an example that we're really quite proud of. We have projects in wind, where we create a new industry-university partnership called Elios, which brought an $8 million DOE grant into the state of Minnesota to help make us a hub of wind energy innovation and training. Professor Ned Mohan has been leading a new project with a $2.5 million DOE grant that is training people all over the country, shown in this map, with Minnesota being the headquarters of that, training mostly students in vocational and two-year colleges around the country and how to be the power engineers of tomorrow, who's going to build and maintain these new infrastructures we're going to critically need. And Minnesota is playing a leading role nationally in that effort. And that includes 81 different colleges, vo-tech schools, and universities nationwide. Also, Jane Davidson, who's behind me, is doing pioneering work and using solar energy, but also learning how to capture and store it. So it's not just during the daytime, but we can use it throughout during clouds and nighttime as well to make sure these technologies are useful to every possible end. So with that, the bottom line of our mission is to provide economic benefits, energy security, and environmental benefits. We believe we pioneered new innovation and research, new technologies, and greatly leveraged Minnesota's early investment many-fold in terms of bringing additional dollars to the state, creating new jobs, new business opportunities to the state of Minnesota. Looking to the future, we believe that we could do our job well and better if we had stronger integration with the other parts of the RDF portfolio. That's something we look forward to, and look forward to the wisdom of this committee in learning how we could do that better. And moving these technologies forward to deployment and commercialization, and bringing the power of business and innovation together here in Minnesota. And with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Mr. Foley, or Mr. Larkin, how does the IRE process, as far as reviewing these projects, differ from the RDF board and their review of the projects that are submitted?
Madam Chair, Mr. Larkin's going to also maybe add to my thoughts here. I'm not as familiar with the other RDF processes. I can only tell you what we do in depth. I can tell you that our process is extremely rigorous and is up to at least the national standards, if not beyond that, especially in the last 2 years that that Rod and I have been working for the university. I know we can guarantee that. It is a national-level review, considered to be as good as anything done by the federal government or better, using some of the smartest people in the country. It is off, completely hands-off, peer review done by some of the nation's leading technical experts from the best universities, companies, and institutions.
And Mr. Foley, you know, the purpose stated for the RDF fund is to the funds in the account may be expended only for the development of the renewable energy sources. And your definition that was given to you, I believe, in either 08 or 09 is quite broad. And I think that's something we need to really take a look at to make sure that these dollars that are appropriated out and for the advancement of electricity and for the ratepayer, the XL ratepayer. So, I mean, if anybody gets a chance, you should look at 116C.779, subdivision 3. I could read it all, but I prefer not to. It's quite broad, and you've got some really wonderful projects in here, but they also fit that definition, but I'm not sure if they fit the definition of the RDF fund. So there is a clash here that I see. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Madam Chair. You saved my second question because you asked it. Thank you.
Oh.
But another issue identified by the legislative auditor, and it kind of builds off your review question, which is the question of communicating results. And legislative auditor cites the succinct, easily digestible way that the RDF board communicates its results. Of course, REPI is fairly straightforward. For the REPI payment piece, they cite the template or the model of the LCCMR. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you put a lot out into the world, and you talked about the convenings, and you probably do a lot of journals and that sort of thing. But do you have any thoughts to share about how to better, more succinctly communicate the results to the public and to the legislature, so that we can better assess the value that the use of these RDF funds are delivering?
Mr. Foley?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, you touched upon one of my personal daily frustrations with my fellow scientists and engineers, is their ability to communicate clearly. As you can imagine, some of these things are very technical and sometimes get a little bit hard to explain. We work very, very hard on that and took the concerns raised by the legislative auditor very seriously. Since that time, we've made sure that a succinct, plain English summary of every project is always available on our website, and we'll make sure to do that well in the future. It's just a kind of a constant battle when you're in the R&D space to make sure things are just intelligible and succinct for a ratepayer or taxpayer. And that's a daily battle with us, and we continue to work on that, and we'll do a better job in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that, on page 15 of the OLA's report, it's interesting that in 2006, the Public Utility Commission recognized where the funds are coming in from. To Senator Jungbauer's point, it's a short mission statement. I'll read it. It says, the overall purpose, parentheses, mission, of the fund is to increase the market penetration of renewable energy resources at reasonable cost in the Xcel Energy Service territory, promote the startup, expansion, and attraction of renewable energy projects and companies in the Xcel Energy Service territory, and stimulate research and development into renewable technologies that support this mission. So I think there's a real clear recognition of where these funds come from and exactly who should, be the major benefit of the results. And so although, I know all different varieties, biomass, everything is a very noble cause, I think that when we're using those funds, there should be maybe a little narrowing of the scope to recognize exactly who should be the major beneficiary of the funds that we're using. That would be my comment.
Okay, thank you. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Foley, just kind of thinking back to what the chairman, Madam Chair, was talking about, chairwoman, Madam Chair, was talking about, and what went into law and how broad it was, do you know, you're new, but did anybody ever talk to you about how this deal was brokered to start this Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota out of those funds?
Mr. Foley?
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, one clarification. The Institute on the Environment is actually a larger umbrella organization under which this IRE program is part of, so those are somewhat separate. Dick Hemmingson, who is the normal day-to-day director of the IRE program, is not here today, and Ron and I are relatively new. But, yeah, he's told us many times about the history of this program, and I believe former Senator Kelly was one of the authors of this legislation, is in attendance here, and I'm sure he'd be happy to tell us more about that. But I believe that we are following the intent of the legislation quite closely and been following that. But clearly public policy changes with lawmakers' intent changing over time, so we'd welcome the clarification from this group and others to tell us, you know, what is the real mission of this program moving forward. Should it be narrower? Should it be broader? Should it be refined? I think what we feel is the most important part of this, though, is the role of innovation and research and really the overall portfolio that the economic opportunities of tomorrow are going to be invented through innovation combined with business together. And that's something that, you know, we believe whatever happens to the RDF is going to be crucial, and we'd like to be part of that. With further clarification from lawmakers, of course.
Senator Jungbaum.
Madam Chair, Mr. Foley, again, trying to be very clear that I think you're doing good work. I think it's our job in the Energy Committee here to decide whether it's RDF or the SIP program or other programs, what are the definitions, what programs fit it, and how do we fit and make sure that I've been very clear in this committee and other committees as well. I want to be the number one innovators in America, in Minnesota here. I want to support that kind of innovation that moves us forward. So we really need to decide how does it fit, where does it fit, how to, and it's good to know, and Senator Kelly has often told me about the historic nature of how things came to be, and I really appreciate that because we need to know where we came from in order to know where we're going and plan those things
absolutely
properly.
Absolutely, Senator Jungbauer. I think that's a very good a point you make, and I believe that we're just here to understand the fund, understand where it's going, where it's been, but also everybody reach a comfort level with it. Any further questions for the two? Thank you very much, Mr. Larkin and Mr. Foley. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Commissioner Wergen, Senator Wergen, what do we call you? Friend?
Betsy. Good afternoon,
Commissioner
Madam
Wergen,
Chair.
Nice to see you.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon, and committee members, and thank you for inviting the Public Utilities Commission to be here. I am the newest commission member, but I drew the short straw for today, so what you see is what you get. The others are at a very important opportunity to learn more about how Minnesota fits into the national grid and things like that, and so I am not there this particular time, so here I am. It was interesting to hear Senator Dibble mention Senator Rest, because when I went back and read the statute that established the RDF, my very first thought was, I bet you Senator Rest wasn't chairing the local government committee when this one happened.
That's right.
She's always been very good at establishing how boards should be done. I understand that on Tuesday you had somewhat of a review of how the RDF process works.
Right.
And so I don't have a formal presentation for you. I just wanted to be able to answer any questions that I could. And again, I am the newest member of the commission. As a matter of fact, on the commission at this point in time, there is no commissioner that was there at the time that the original RDF board was actually started. And so the institutional memory is just a little short. We have to go back to records and find some of those things. But I will answer any questions that you have that I can possibly answer, or we will get the answers for you at a later time.
Senator DeBoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So getting back to the questions that Senator Jungbauer, you and Senator Howe asked, I think the last solicitation comes in the form of an order from the PUC, was very specific about identifying projects that don't have to do with the production of electricity as ineligible. Clearly the PUC has a notion that the original intent of the RDF had to do with renewable energy production, perhaps not transportation fuels and transportation energy. Does the PUC, do you have a sense that the PUC in any sense has an opinion about how the other parts of the RDF resources are being used by other entities?
Commissioner Wergen.
Do they hold those opinions or have those thoughts or give guidance back to us in that regard?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, we pay very close attention, of course, to the part that we have any jurisdiction with and in how that's allocated and to whom. But as far as the portions that are legislatively mandated or go to the University of Minnesota, we actually have very little involvement. And virtually no involvement in the University of Minnesota portion. And so while an individual commissioner may have an opinion about a project that goes through, we as a commission don't have any formal part of those processes.
Thanks.
Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Wergen, thanks for being here. Good to see you. One of the things we've struggled with is it seems like this whole RDF has taken kind of a dual track where part of it's legislatively mandated, part of it goes through the PUC. So I guess as we move forward, I'm trying to help us all out as members to say, do you have an opinion as PUC? I'm looking at your caseload and I'm thinking, do you really have time to do this, or should we take it over and kind of change the direction of how it gets funded and goes out there, more like an LCCMR type of model, although I have my issues with that. But, you know, the legislative auditor had mentioned some things in terms of that. I don't remember the exact details because I don't have them in front of me. But I guess the bottom line is, do you have the time at the PUC, or are you otherwise busy, and do you have an opinion on how this should be administered? Because I think it should kind of all be under one umbrella instead of multiple.
Commissioner Wergen.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Jungbauer, thank you.
Commissioner, I got elevated.
Did I say commissioner?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
But I like that. It's an elevation.
Jungbauer. Well, yeah, either one. But Senator Jungbauer, that's really not for me to answer. The legislature, of course, it's under your purview to decide how the fund is handled. We at the commission, of course, are very busy. The rate cases have been quite prolific, and they are long, and they take a whole lot of energy and a lot of staff time to establish. But I, for one, and I believe our full commission would say that if you give us a job, we'll do it, and we'll do it to the best of our ability. I'm not one to say, I'm sorry, we just can't do that. That simply doesn't work in my world. We would do it the best we could, and if we could potentially get more resources to deal with it, we would certainly do that. But what I do want to assure you of is that any portion of the fund that we do have any jurisdiction over, we will certainly pay very close attention to and be very diligent about falling within the four corners of the statute and making sure that everything that's funded fits within what the legislation calls for.
Senator Brown?
Yes, Madam Chair, Commissioner Wergen, thank you for being here. The question I'm going to ask may be prior to your time on the PUC, but as I'm looking through the legislative auditor's report, there's a list in the back of grants that were awarded, and one of them that stands out to me is in the amount of $10 million to the Mesaba Excelsior Energy Coal Gasification. Is that a grant that you can comment on?
Commissioner Wergen?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I can give you a very high-level comment, but really not digging down into the details. I do know that at the last round that was approved was in April of 2008, and I came on the commission in August of 2008. Mm-hmm. So the actual groundwork that was done for that approval and how that particular project came to be approved, I don't have any real in-depth knowledge of. But I do know that the commission, once the RDF board had rejected that project, when it came in front of the commission, they reversed that particular opinion. I would have to go back to all of the testimony to find out why, but I do know that it was a unanimous decision of the board. And so for some reason, they must have felt that it fit well within the statute.
Thank you.
Commissioner, just looking at some of the projects that have been awarded that are closed and some that are still in progress, going back to Senator Metzen's comments about appropriating out of the state, and there's a lot of money out of the state, a tremendous amount of state, and so I guess I'd like to have you comment on that and see if you understand our angst about that situation and what the reasoning behind that.
Madam Chair, I most certainly do understand your angst about that. I neglected to mention, too, that I have with me Susan McKenzie. Susan has been at the commission since the RDF statute was implemented, and so she knows this information probably better than I do. That is a big concern. It's a little bit misleading to simply look at that chart, because something that may say that it went to California, a California company, That may be the headquarters for a company that's doing something in Minnesota. And one of the best examples of that is some funding that was awarded to a company in California, but it's for a hydro project here in Minnesota. And so some of that is a little bit misleading, but there are certainly some monies that have gone out of state for an out-of-state project. And my first, when the red flags went up seeing that, my first thing was to go back to the statute. And the statute says preference must be given to the development of renewable energy source projects located within the state. And so my assumption is that when the commission was approving some of those projects as far back as the late 90s, that they assumed that there would be Minnesota ratepayer benefit from the project, even if it was developed somewhere else. So that's the only reason that I can give you. The other reassurance that I'd like to give is that Xcel ratepayers pay into this fund, and when Xcel looks at these projects and works with the RDF board and recommends a list of projects, I believe they're keenly aware, at least that would be my assumption, of the fact that this is their ratepayers' money, and somehow when they're with the RDF board and coming forward with these recommendations, there must be an assumption that their ratepayers are going to benefit in some way. But I do have that same concern that you do.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's ever good to assume.
That is correct.
Yes. I think... And it's still perplexing to me that here Minnesota has this wonderful RDF fund, which I think has done a tremendous amount of benefit. No other state has anything like this. So if we can fine-tune this to get it to benefit the Minnesota ratepayers, especially the Xcel, whatever we want to do with that, I think that's something we need to focus on.
And Madam Chair, I assure you that as you go forward studying the statute and anticipating changes, that I would be happy to, and so would any other member of the commission, to work with you to make sure mm-hmm. that we're guaranteeing that this works for Minnesota ratepayers and specifically Xcel ratepayers, because that's who the money is being collected from.
And Commissioner, you might have been after this started, but do you remember the reason why the legislature started getting into some of this selection process? Because prior to this, it was just the RDF board and the PUC and Xcel, but then the legislature started designating some of these dollars, the $10 million specifically.
Madam Chair, are you addressing specifically the portion that are legislative mandates, I assume?
No, some of the appropriating some of the dollars that were given, so like the $10 million that Senator Brown was mentioning.
So that would be some of the legislative mandates. My assumption is that, well, having served here, my assumption is that some particular senator or representative had a constituency base that was interested in seeing a project funded and came here with a bill suggesting that the funding come from the RDF fund because somehow they felt that it fit within that. But I would suspect that that is where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't help but make a comment. I think you should ask Senator Tomasoni, because it was his idea, and many of us thought and still think it was a really bad idea and didn't meet the requirements of the fund and really ripped off our ratepayers, and I still think that. So I think it was not an appropriate use of renewable development fund dollars, but that's what happens in the legislature. If you can get a majority to vote for something, mm-hmm. it becomes law. And so I guess the temptation was too great to seize some money mm-hmm. from a fund. Mm-hmm. And that's my story. Obviously, I have strong feelings about it. Not everybody would agree with you, but you might want to check in with Senator Tomasoni, because it was his doing and his bill. And, you know, I don't think there's anything to show for that money, and it's really a shame.
Thank you, Senators. So, Commissioner, if I can ask, would you prefer that either the legislature takes control of this money or we keep it within? I know what the answer is going to be, but I don't think this dual-track process is working and does not really institute a level of comfort for anybody when you have a money appropriating out of the door where not everybody's on board with this.
Madam
opinions
Chair,
on that?
Madam Chair, I think it's real safe to say that the legislative auditor had that same feeling. I think they basically recommended that it be one or the other and somehow that it be streamlined or more accountable. That's certainly obvious. And again, we at the commission would certainly look to the law and follow the process as close as we could, and I believe we would do a very good job of it. However, if the legislature decides to set up some form of commission, be it something like the LCCMR or something else, as long as it's well through and has the mission spelled out in statute, I think the main piece is to get it underneath one umbrella so that it actually does what the law wants it to do and that the law be better spelled out so that that can happen.
Thank you. Ms. McKenzie, would you anything you'd like to add?
Well, I was just going to say one of the reasons I think the funds were available because the board typically waited till there were over $20 million in the fund to go out for a cycle of bidding. So I think it might have appeared that there were funds sitting there in need of a source.
Placement.
Yeah, and so that might have been played into.
Very interesting. Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. McKenzie and Commissioner Wergen. Really appreciate
your
testimony. And thank you, members, for staying in there a little bit longer. This was a great hearing. March 1st, we're going to try our MISO tour again. So we are scheduled for that. And starting this Thursday, we're going to be reviewing the Conservation Improvement Program Thursday and next Tuesday. So that is the schedule for the next couple meetings. So thank you. With that, the meeting is adjourned.